Good evening. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Limar. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And for those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is to get people's questions answered. A little bit of education, a little bit of entertainment. The way a person signs into the TechNet is to give me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
KCQMWA with a question.
And good evening, K2KY.
Okay, I think I heard K2KEY, and who was the other person?
KCQMWA.
Okay, we've got Bob and Mel. Anyone else to check in?
This be KA2HTV. No questions.
Okay, HTV with a no, Bob with a yes, Mel always with a yes. Anyone else? More and more of those Cornell Dubilier capacitors, brand new off the shelf at I was in radio and places like that, and I soon realized even sitting on the shelf they were drying out. See, if you went to a good motor start capacitor of the right number of microfarads, you got tremendous torque and it lasted a long time. In your particular case, 210 to 290, I'm amazed that it's that high. 35 volts, I can see that. But you think it's polarized and not, and I think you said you didn't think it's a non-polarized capacitor. I've seen people make a temporary AC electrolytic capacitor by putting a pair of appropriate size capacitors back to back. Some of the really brave people will do it without even putting diodes across them. The smart person will put diodes across them. If the right capacitance you really wanted, 210 to 290, let's see, it's a delta of 80, I add 40, so 250 is the mid-value they want. If you had a pair of 500 microfarad capacitors and you hooked them up back-to-back with diodes across them to make sure that the right polarity takes place, you would be able to create an AC electrolytic capacitor of 250 microfarads. Don't be fooled by the diodes becoming a short circuit, and therefore you think the capacitance is not two capacitors in series. Yes, when you first start it up, when it's charging, the diodes do some conducting. Once the whole thing is in operation for a second or so, the capacitors become fully charged DC-wise, then only the AC voltage is across them, and only a little bit of a peak voltage period do the diodes conduct. So therefore, you really do want twice the capacitance of each individual capacitor when you put them back to back in order to make this 250 mic. So that's one possible suggestion. I wonder if I've misunderstood your problem a little bit, Bob. KC2MWA, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. It's definitely polarized because I'm looking at the plastic case where the two wire leads come out. One's got a plus, one's got a minus, and it shows it as a polarized capacitor in the schematic diagram. So I guess I could try and find a couple of 35 volts 500, or if I can find a 250 at 35, I can try that in there and see if it makes any difference.
Yeah, give me some of the symptoms, Bob. First of all, when you look at the schematic diagram, I see what's going on. I'm turning the wrong volume control. I'm using a different receiver from the normal. When you look at the schematic diagram, I presume this is a phase-shifting capacitor that's in series with one of the motor windings, the motor winding that determines whether or not the motor turns clockwise or counterclockwise, and I'm presuming AC voltage goes to that motor. I think there are some rotators which use a DC motor, and therefore things are kind of different. So before we go any further, are we sure that it's an AC motor and that AC voltage is applied to the motor windings, and this capacitor, depending on which switch you got the forward and reverse switch position in, it throws the capacitor on one winding or the other winding, determining clockwise or counterclockwise? So far, does the schematic seem to appear that way, Bob? Go ahead.
Okay, that's what I thought when I first looked at it. I'm looking at it here, and a couple of wires have faded out on this probably 40th copy of an original that I've got here. They seem to be going, going across. I'm mumbling, don't find me for a second while I figure out where things are going. Okay. The motor has three wires going to it, showing two field coils. The common is a black wire. The other two sides of the individual windings are a brown and a red, and the capacitor is across the brown and the red. So the only thing I can figure out is what they're doing is they're either switching AC to the brown transport to the red and always to the black, and that's how we're changing the motor direction.
Thank you. Please, God, Dick.
Okay, one other quick question, Bob, before I turn it over to Mel, and that is it a 60-cycle AC transformer winding, which is feeding power into the motor assembly? Back to you, Bob.
As near as I can tell, that is the case. There's some relays in here which are not too obvious in terms of how they work. I'm going to wind up redrawing this whole thing. Yeah, that's coming. Yeah, those two windings are being controlled by a low voltage rotor. There's also a relay, rather. There's also a high voltage relay in here.
Those relays are fired with AC, not DC?
Well, since there's no rectifiers in here, I got to assume that everything is running on AC.
Okay, I'm with you. Mel, sounds to me like you've got some familiarity with the Alliance rotator. K2KUY, you got it.
Roger, this is K2KUY. I'm going to use mostly, I've seen them, you know, a lot of them used on the years on TVs, TV rotor, basically. Is this, Bob, is this one the, is this a four-wire control wire that goes up to the rotor from the box? Is this four wires over?
No, Mel, it's five.
The fifth one, all right, I'm trying to picture which line. Okay, the condenser in there, is it a brown colored capacitor with two spectrum leads coming out of one side of the capacitor, both black, the leads, over?
No, the capacitor is white with two red leads coming out of it.
Okay, this is the later model then. All right, I'm thinking of the earlier model. I know the earlier model with the four wires. This one has a fifth wire. I know. So this one, the control box. The control box on this one, does it have a meter, or is this one the one that clicks over?
It doesn't click, and it doesn't have a meter. What they're doing is there's a potentiometer in the rotor housing and a potentiometer in the control box. And apparently when both of those resistances are equal, it thinks it's in the right position.
Okay. Does it have a motor in the control box? Was it a self? No, I'm wondering. That's a new one. I'm not familiar with that control box. Does it have a motor, another motor, in the control box? Over.
No, it does not.
I've got a guess on this one. My guess is that the potentiometer in the control box is the command potentiometer. The potentiometer in the rotator indicates the position you're at, and the center taps of those two potentiometers have a circuit that senses that the voltage between the two is either positive or negative, meaning that the error is either clockwise or counterclockwise, and the rotator moves until that error goes to zero and then stops moving. Is that approximately the way it works, Bob?
Yeah, I'm gathering that's the case, but it's not like the potentiometer is being used as a balance. It's just like a variable resistor in both cases.
But that's still the same philosophy of operation. In other words, as you study the schematic, do you see the possibility that a person could decide to walk up to the machine, the control box, turn the knob clockwise or counterclockwise? It will therefore generate in the control box a different voltage than the corresponding potentiometer in the rotator top side is doing. That difference in voltage will be sensed in such a way that it flips a relay to move it counterclockwise or counterclockwise, clockwise or counterclockwise, in order to drive that error voltage to zero. And when that error voltage is zero, in other words, both pots have the same resistance, the thing stops moving. It goes to a neutral state. Is this an Alliance rotator that you personally have owned, or are you repairing one that you've acquired and you're trying to get it back in operation? Back to you, Bob.
Well, Dick, something I picked up off of eBay. It looked brand new, came in the original box. It looked like it had ever been used outdoors. But I'm just considering the age of it, because I believe it was made in 78. So it's a little old to the tooth, as we say, so any of the parts inside could be suspect. It worked fine up until about a week ago, and then the antenna stopped moving.
Okay. You probably are familiar with the technique that Mel and I and a lot of people have used, in which you take a digital voltmeter in the ohmmeter scale. You use one of the high ohmmeter settings, like a 1 mega ohm full scale or 200K full scale. You put the two leads across the suspect capacitor, and you will see the needle move. In other words, if it was a volt ohm, if you were using a vacuum tube voltmeter in the ohmmeter scale, you would watch the capacitor charge when you try to measure resistance across the two terminals of the capacitor. The rate at which it charges gives you a strong indication as to how many microfarads are left in the capacitor. And so if you had another 250 microfarad capacitor, and you put your ohmmeter across it, you watch the voltage change, the rate at which it changes. Let's say it takes 30 seconds in order to charge to half scale, so to speak. And if the suspect capacitor, you do the exact same test, and it comes up to half scale in 1 second instead of 30 seconds, it's a very strong indication that your capacitor has dried out and it's a much lower number of microfarads today. So that's one test you can do. Another test you can do, as we said before, is to put a pair of 500 microfarads back-to-back with diodes across them. And the diodes will be in such a way that will allow the correct polarity. So, in other words, the cathode of the diode would go on the positive lead of the capacitor in each case. So each capacitor will have a diode directly across it. The two capacitors are in series back-to-back. And now, by way of the diodes, the capacitors never get a reverse charge. Most electrolytic capacitors, if they ever see a reverse charge, suffer at least partial damage, if not complete damage. You take, for instance, a tantalum capacitor that you're hooking up to a solid-state circuit, and you make the mistake of hooking it up backwards, and you apply B+. In some cases, the thing will actually do a minor explosion. I've seen that happen on a number of occasions. So even though there are people who have made a substitute capacitor for this situation by putting capacitors back-to-back without the diodes, I do not recommend you do it without the diodes. You get a lot more life out of a capacitor, so to speak. And so usually when a capacitor starts drying out, the rotator becomes kind of cranky, moves slowly. You command it clockwise or counterclockwise. It doesn't move for a while, and then it starts moving. That's the way capacitors usually fail, and eventually the day comes when nothing moves at all. But yours just suddenly completely stopped on one particular day. Let's hope it is the capacitor. There's a slim chance that it's not. Back to you, Bob. KC2MWA, drag your feet in case other people have more familiarity with that 1978 Alliance rotator. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, I'm looking for the easy solution. The difficult one is I trip the gear, and the motor is actually running, but the potentiometer, because the mechanism isn't moving, isn't changing its resistance. That's the other possibility. Not to be overlooked, we might I'd rather not have to climb up on the roof and take everything apart again, but that may be the spring project, new rotor time.
I may have the answer.
Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, did it stop on the end? Was it on one of the ends that it got stuck over?
Yeah, it may be towards one end.
Okay, the limit switch in the rotor, I remember now. There's a little micro switch they have for inside the rotor, and when they get laying around for a long time, they get sticky. They're greased. I remember the grease in there hardened up, Dick. I took one apart, and that was the problem. It got stuck on one end because the grease hardened up and it dicked over.
Most rotators will have a limit switch on the end, which if, for instance, you command clockwise and don't let up on your command clockwise, the thing comes to the end and you keep commanding more clockwise, the motor is in the stuck rotor mode, everything overheats and is subject to failure. So they put a limit switch which will not allow you to go more clockwise than north and more counterclockwise than a little bit to the right of north, if you know what I mean. In my case of my 8-wire HMM rotators, when those limit switches fail, there's a way that you can rewire things so that you still get rotation. However, you want to make sure you don't come to the end, otherwise you get stuck there, so to speak. I'm in that situation right now. So that sounds to me like something you're going to have to investigate. In the case of stripping the gears, you probably know by looking at the size of the rotator roughly how many pounds and how many square feet of wind area the antenna would be appropriate for it. Many of us push our luck. I mean, I've taken a great big array of 16 Yagis, which was 15 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep. You know, a few thousand cubic feet of antenna. And beginning, I rotated that with an AR-22, overloading that rotator by about 10 or 20 to 1. But because my antenna was carefully wind balanced, I got away with it for a short period of time until I finally put in a full-size HMM rotator in there. So in your case, whether or not you've put a great big long antenna on a rotator that's a little bit inappropriate for it, you'd know that. And by the way, even if you did do it, you'd get away with it if you put a weather vane on the back of that beam so that it is wind balanced. So what's your guess as to whether or not you may have overloaded it and stripped the gears? But since it's stuck in one end, I think Mel's right. I think there's a high probability you're stuck at a limit switch. KC2MWA, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KC2MWA. Yeah, it could be the limit switch. It is kind of stuck up towards the northerly direction. I do not think that the rotor's got enough wind. The antenna has enough wind load on it that it would be a major problem. It's, there are probably TV antennas that have more wind load than my 6-meter beam, but it's only a 3-element with a 8-foot boom. I don't imagine it's all that much wind load.
I agree with you, Bob. Now, I guess you wanted to know, first of all, is the motor turning? But if the limit switch is doing its thing, you'd get an indication of no motor turn. The fact that you just suddenly stopped as opposed to getting cranky and eventually getting harder and harder to turn, right now, I'm not believing that your capacitor is bad. I think I'm going to go with Mel's analysis on this one, the limit switch, which does sound like you're going to have to go top side to go to the next step, Bob. Is this on your chimney or on top of the tower? Are you going to have to bring in the rigging crew to get to the top of your 100-foot structure? Back to you, Bob.
No, it's on a very easy-to-get-to roof, but it just helps because of the size of things to have two people. So we'll see what happens. I guess it's going to be on the roof time.
Yeah, one thing to try is that if somebody is down below with a handy talkie giving commands to the control box clockwise and counterclockwise, at the same time a second person is topside with a handy talkie and trying to force the rotator clockwise or counterclockwise, particularly away from the stop, there's a 50-50 chance you can get it back in operation by mechanically rocking it off the stop where the limit switch goes back into the normal mode. And you'll be back in operation. On top of that, the person topside can listen to whether or not he hears the motor rotating and so on. So before you completely take it apart, I would try the mechanical forcing operation with simultaneous command down below. Does that make some sense, Bob? Go ahead.
Yeah, all right. Well, you gave me a bunch of things to try. I'm going to shut down because my son's got the radio going full blast in the other room. I, here, Sounds like he's wrecking the house. I'm going to turn it back to next. Pick up the next person, please.
Okay, Bob. And you got us all on the edge of our seat, so please come back either later tonight, if you get some service tonight, or next week, and let us know what you discovered. I think the next person with a yes question was Barry, KC2, Mike Lima Tango. Mike Lima, is it Tango or Juliet? I'm going to say Juliet. You got it, Barry. Sounds like Barry's not there. Did I skip over somebody so far with real questions? And so give me your call letters and name right now.
K2MLB, Frank.
Okay, Frank. Looks like I did skip over you. I made the mistake of putting too many no's and you're a yes. You got it, Frank.
K2MLB returning. Well, first of all, Dick, haven't spoken to you in way, way over a year. I'm anxious to know. I guess you're hearing me okay. My antenna system, which is four Yagis up in an H-frame, is completely out of commission. I just stuck a little seven-element beam on a 20-foot pipe that's on that basketball backboard in the backyard, and it's only about 20 feet off the ground. So I'm in West Orange, New Jersey, about 20 miles west of New York City. Is the copy good enough for me to continue?
You are almost dead full quieting into the machine, and you are S5 at MyQTH in Huntington, Long Island, 35 miles east of New York City. So you're getting out like gangbusters, Frank. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Well, to refresh your memory slightly, I've enjoyed doing receiver testing going back to when Wes Hayward first wrote those articles in QSD, Dynamic Range, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, even though I do it, I have no background in electronics. I'm not an engineer. My business was construction. So what I'm saying is I'm only a ham. So I'm giving you that preface as a prelude to your possible answer. In other words, when I run the receiver test, I follow the ARRL procedure, kind of cookbook style, and I've run into problems in the past with noise limiting and so forth, which you were very helpful on. But here's my question. I'm on 80 meters a lot and on a noisy band, and let's just put it this way. If there were a lot of intermod products creating some difficulties, you know, I would understand that if we switched in, let's just say, 6 dB of attenuation in the front end, that the second order products would be reduced by 12 dB and the third order products by 18, etc., and we would be helping the situation in terms of reducing intermod interference with the desired signal. Now, knowing that, and the guys that I talk to understand that more or less, with a very noisy band, and I mean just not IMD products, but just static or atmospheric noise or whatever, you know, they'll get on and say, okay, this is very noisy, I just switched in 12 dB, you know, to help things out. So I guess my question is, not understanding the vagrancies of, let's say, random noise, is it possible that that kind of noise follows either square law or cube law or not? I guess I'm thinking that if I do that in that circumstance, that if I put in 6 dB of attenuation, yeah, the noise goes down 6 dB, but so does the desired signal. So I wonder if you could clarify that for me.
Yeah, Don, good question, Frank. And a little bit on the complicated side, and it's all going to be super clear the first time you hear it, and so you're allowed to come back and ask the question three times in a row, and we'll eventually make it a little bit more clear. When you do a two-tone test, it's the best way of testing linearity of any kind of a, particularly RF amplifier, but it could also be an audio amplifier. The magic about a two-tone test is that if it was your hearing system, your hearing would definitely hear two separate tones. In the case of an amplifier that is more broadband than the spacing between the two tones, let's assume now I'm testing an amplifier that operates between 3.5 and 4 megacycles. So it's at least a 500 kC wide amplifier, reasonably flat across that frequency region. And I decided to do a two-tone test where I put in one tone at 3.6 megacycles, and I put in a second tone we'll say 10 kilohertz higher, 3.601 megacycles, if I did that correctly. There's really two tones there. You can tune across with a single sideband receiver and tune across each one of them in the narrow CW mode, so to speak. You only pick up one at a time. Or if you've got a broader bandwidth, you would hear the two tones. If your hearing is broad enough in frequency range, you would hear the fact that there's two tones 10 kc apart. So with a good audio spectrum analyzer, with a good RF spectrum analyzer, with a good hearing system, there truly are true tones. As far as the amplifier is concerned, there's only one tone there with a very complicated waveform. You could set your synchroscope, so to speak, to the lower tone, the 3.6 megs. The one that is 10 kc higher, because it's higher in frequency, is advancing in phase more rapidly. 10 kilohertz is the spacing I give it. Let me backtrack and make it 1 kilohertz of spacing. With 1 kilohertz of spacing, you've got one signal at 3.6 megs, the other signal is 3.6001 megacycles. And so, timing-wise, 1 kilohertz of difference means that you go through a complete cycle of the pair of signals every 1 millisecond. 1 kc of difference, I divide 1 kc into 1, I get 1 millisecond. That's the amount of time that if I set my vectorscope, I called it, I could call it a circular diagram type graph paper, polar graph paper. I set my polar graph paper so that the lower signal is giving me an up arrow of unity length, and then the second arrow, which represents the higher frequency signal, 1 kilohertz higher, it rotates around my my polar graph, one complete rotation every millisecond. As you look at that rotation, there's a period of time when the two signals are exactly in phase. They're both at 12 o'clock. There's a little bit later period of time when the higher frequency signal is at 3 o'clock, when the low frequency signal is at 1 o'clock on my polar diagram. At a later time, the higher frequency signal is at 6 o'clock. Let's stop right there for a second. At the instant of time, your second signal is at 6 o'clock on my polar diagram, and your first signal is at 12 o'clock, the two signals are 180 degrees out of phase. For that instant of time, there is absolutely no summed composite voltage going into the amplifier. The amplifier is seeing absolutely no signal during that instant of time. At the earlier time, when they were both at 12 o'clock, the two voltages were being added, and the amplifiers saw full blast power. So what a two-tone test really does is, in this particular example, once every millisecond, your amplifier is going from full blast down to zero and back to full blast in amplitude of the composite pair of two signals into that amplifier. If the amplifier is thoroughly linear, it reproduces that complicated waveform, and what goes out is exactly what you came in. In reality, every amplifier has some degree of nonlinearity, particularly when you make the two tones strong enough. Therefore, there'll be flat topping a little bit on the strong situation when the two signals are co-phase, or there'll be a little bit of crossover distortion at the period of time near the 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock situation when the signals are approaching out of phase. There'll be some kind of nonlinearity. Any kind of nonlinearity in amplitude of phase of the transfer characteristics of that amplifier will show up on a good spectrum analyzer as other products being created. The two nearby guys, we call them third order DeMod. The one on the right is due to second harmonic of the higher signal mixing with the fundamental of the first. The lower signal to the left of the phony guy, third order DeMod, is the second harmonic of the first mixing with the fundamental of the second. And so that's what creates your thirds. Your fifths are not 2x1s, they're 3x2s. Third harmonic of one, second harmonic of the other, mixing, and so on. When you lower the two tones going into an amplifier on the test, while you're looking at some kind of a spectrum analyzer display, they move by a 3-to-1 ratio in absolute power. In other words, if I lower the two signals by 10 dB, the third order mods, whatever they were, go down by 30 dB. But because I've lowered the two intermods, the two tones going in by 10, the relationship between the two versus the intermods went down by 20. So relative power goes down by 20. Absolute power goes down by 30 dB when I lower the two inputs by 10 dB. So you get this 3-to-1 relationship on third order intermods. You get a 5-to-1 relationship on fifth order intermods. So this is the way all reasonable amplifiers behave when you're doing a two-tone test. Now, whether or not an amplifier is displaying nonlinear characteristics is a function of at least two different things. Number one, if there's nothing but your two tones going in, your two signals, are those two signals near the point of 1 dB compression? Are they strong enough to start shoving the amplifier into flat topping? That'll certainly make some very strong intermods. The average amplifier, rough rule of thumb, when you're at the point of 1 dB compression, the third order intermods will be 20 dB down relative, 20 dB weaker than the two tones coming out of the amplifier. And if you back off from there by 10 dB, instead of them being 20 dB down, they'll be 40 dB down relative. So I think you see that. So strength of the two tones, that's one of the things that creates amplifier limiting and therefore nonlinearity and capable of making intermods. Broadband noise can also do it. Or an out-of-band signal can do it. Your amplifier that you think is operating from 3.5 to 4 may really have a significant amount of gain at 4.1. And maybe some Mars station a block away is giving you a potent signal at 4.1. You've got your spectrum analyzer set between 3.6 and 3.65, we'll say. And so you're looking at the region where you're injecting the two tones. You're not looking at the frequency region on the spectrum analyzer where this other strong tone is coming in. So you don't even see what's happening, but the poor amplifier does. So an out-of-band signal can shove an amplifier into limiting and give you some crazy characteristics. That's one situation. Another is broadband noise. If the amplifier is rated to have great performance at 3.5 to 4, but it just happens to operate at 0.1 megacycles to 10 megacycles, inclusive, and you happen to have no pre-selecting filter in front of it, all of those zillions of signals across all of those numbers of megacycles and all of that noise coming in could also be creating nonlinearity. This is particularly troublesome with, say, for instance, 2-meter transceivers. The average all-mode 2-meter transmitter, or FM rig like the one you're listening to right now, they usually have a bandpass filter that covers 144 to 148 inclusive. That's the places where it has very little insertion loss, and the filter probably goes a megacycle beyond on each end. So there's a lot of potential signals coming through there all at once that give you some peculiar characteristics of your 2-meter rig. There were a few 2-meter all-mode rigs, like there was a Yaesu BC221, I think it was. I don't remember the exact model number. Popular around 1980 or so, 1975, when it first came out, which had a true tracking front end. When you tuned it from the low end of the band to the high end of the band, around 144 to 148, it had a filter that followed you, and the filter was about 50 kilohertz wide. It essentially let through one signal at a time. And the nice thing about that particular rig is, boy, it was very hard to overload. It was a real robust receiver. So now your original question is, what happens when you put in 10 dB of padding? In the case of the noise power coming in on 80 meters on the average day with a dipole-like antenna listening to 80 meters, the total noise power coming in that antenna is approximately equivalent to a 40 or 50 decibel noise figure receiver. In other words, all of those thousands of thunderstorms going on all around the world, all that ionospheric noise, all that aurora borealis noise, lights, all of those fluorescent lights that are a few miles from your home. You put that all together. The 80-meter band, in general, is pretty darn noisy. Therefore, when you plug in 10 dB of attenuation, because the noise coming into your receiver is, on average, 30 decibels louder than the threshold sensitivity of the receiver. And you can prove that by running single generator tests, looking at what the S-meter is doing, then connecting it to your antenna, and looking at what the S-meter is doing. You can confirm that in most conditions, in most cases, the 80-meter band noise is considerably louder than the sensitivity of your receiver. Therefore, when you plug in 10 dB of attenuation, yes, you're lowering the desired signal by 10, but you're also lowering the noise by 10, but you haven't come anywhere near the sensitivity yet of the receiver, and maybe you can even plug in 20 dB before you come near the sensitivity limit of the receiver. In which case, when you plug in the attenuation, in signal-to-noise ratio, you don't lose, but in intermod characteristics, you gain. If the total noise power, strong signals, or whatever, coming into that receiver, was getting it at some frequency near the point of limiting. And by the way, an amplifier that limits way out of band, if it's the amplifier you're looking at, or the receiver you're looking at, that at any frequency is going into limiting, it's hard to believe. You'll have to accept the fact it's in limiting at all frequencies at that instant of time. Whenever an amplifier is limiting, it is limiting. And the fact that you desire to use it at the other end of the band, and that's when you set up the spectrum analyzer to look at what's going on, that doesn't matter. If out of band there's a strong enough signal that gets through that amplifier that shoves it into limiting, you're going to get some crazy characteristics. So by plugging in the 10 dB band, you pick up this tremendous improvement in vulnerability of the receiver going into an overload condition from broadband noise, from lightning static, from out-of-band strong signals, from whatever. So you come out ahead, and it's almost no loss, essentially no loss at all, when you plug in 10 or 20 dB on a good antenna on 80 meters. This also explains why you can take an 80-meter receiver, listen to your favorite friend, who's giving you a reasonably strong signal, unplug your beautiful antenna that's 135 feet long, plug in a random length of wire, a clip lead, to the center conductor of the connector on the back of the receiver, and you hear your friend almost as well as on the whole antenna. And you'll say to yourself, what the heck's going on here? Well, your little random length of wire may be 30 dB worse as an antenna than your full-blown antenna. But since the noise of the band is 40 dB above, you still have a reasonable signal-to-noise ratio. You'll have very little S-meter deflection on that random length of wire, and absolutely positively, you cannot transmit through it, because it probably has a zillion-to-one standing wave ratio. But in many cases, a random length of wire plugged into the receiver gives you pretty good reception. So, maybe this helps a little bit. I know it's not all super clear. But to go ahead and ask some more questions, okay. K2MLB, nice having you back. K2IWM, the TechNet.
Okay, well, thank you, Dick. K2MLB returning. Yeah, that's very fine, and I do understand, and I want to get a little specific, if I may. As I say, I understand in terms if you had two intermodulate, two signals, and the IMD product was falling right on the desired signal, and I understand how the ratio would change 2-to-1 for a second order product, 3-to-1 for a third, and etc. Now, and you might, maybe the simplification and the right answer is do it because it can't hurt. Putting attenuation into the point where you still can hear the desired signal is going to reduce all the IMD products and the out-of-band products, etc. But what I really wanted to know specifically, if you limited it only to the broadband noise, the atmospheric noise, etc., I thought that only reduced in direct ratio to the attenuation. So, as you say, even though we throw 10 dB of attenuation in, the overall noise is still so high that we can still hear the signal, etc. But if we were to compare the signal-to-noise ratio of the desired signal and exclude any out-of-band or intermod product and compare only atmospheric noise and, you know, the man-made noise, the fluorescent lights and whatever, I mean, is that still only one-to-one? Does that broadband noise in any way attenuate in a proportion greater than the reduction of the signal?
Oh, you've asked the beauty of a question, Frank. And now you're getting into one of the real subtleties of amplification. It's called signal cross noise terms and noise cross noise terms. When it comes to plugging in one, two, or three signal generator sine wave signals into an amplifier and varying the amplitudes and the frequency spread and looking at them with a spectrum analyzer and testing limiting characteristics and interbond characteristics, all of that makes a fair amount of sense. All of a sudden, somebody comes along with a broadband noise generator, which could be your 80-meter antenna on a good day, or it could be a real Gaussian white noise generator. In either case, noise has got some very nasty characteristics. In the case of a single sine wave signal, I take, for instance, just to give you a crazy example, assume I'm using the 60-cycle power line, your Con Ed, your LIPA, your New Jersey Power and Light. I'm taking the 115-volt signal, 115-volt power out of your wall, and I'm plugging it into an oscilloscope, and I'm considering it as a 60-cycle sine wave. You know what it looks like. And when you have that voltage at 115 volts RMS on your digital voltmeter, on your voltohmmillimeter, whatever, 115-volt RMS really is 167 volts peak of sine wave. The RMS of 115 volts is the heating value. In other words, if I took that New Jersey Power and Light power out of your wall at 115 volts, plugged it into a exactly 115 ohm power resistor, it would draw exactly 1 watt of RMS current, and it would equal exactly 115 watts of heating. However, my oscilloscope tells me that New Jersey Power and Light signal is hitting 167 volts on the positive peak and 167 volts on the negative peak, but it doesn't dwell there very long. It also goes through zero crossing, and so when you add it all together, it has the heating value of 115 volts, even though it's got a positive and negative peak of 167. You can prove this by looking at the amount of heating you get of that 115 ohm resistor, the 115 watts in my example, or you could plug in exactly 115 volts of DC, and you'll get the exact same amount of heating. So you can see now that the power that New Jersey Power and Light is supplying to you, it has a 41% crest factor. In other words, the peak voltage is 141% of the RMS voltage. So square root of 2 is the crest factor, 1.414. 41.4% is the crest factor of your single sine wave. Now let me take broadband noise that's operating between 3.5 and 4 megacycles inclusive. And I go into some kind of a true RMS power meter, and I decide that the white noise coming out of my white noise generator is 0 dBm mean value. In other words, it's got, if I plug it into a 50 ohm resistor, it's got the exact same heating power as a 0 dBm 1 milliwatt sine wave. So I've got 1 milliwatt of noise. In the case of the 1 milliwatt of sine wave, I know exactly what the peak voltage is going to be, 41% higher. In the case of broadband noise, 0 dBm mean value, RMS value, it probably has a peak value, depending on the quality of the signal generator, which might be plus 30 dBm, 1,000 times higher. I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but it's in this ballpark. Broadband noise could be considered a very large number of individual sine wave generators. You could say one every hertz across the 500 kilohertz of bandwidth. You've got 500 individual small little signal generators all slightly different in amplitude, all exactly 1 hertz different in frequency, and you put them all together, you wait long enough, there's going to be an instant in time when all of those individual sine wave generators, 1 hertz apart, are going to all add up co-phase. So the peak value may be 1 watt, even though the mean value is 1 milliwatt. Broadband noise has that characteristic. Therefore, when you put broadband noise, particularly when you go 1 meg, 2 meg, 5 megs wide, in the case of a 2 meter receiver, the front end is at least 4 or 5 megacycles wide. You're putting in a lot of bandwidth of noise all at once. Therefore, for very brief periods of time, that noise hitting its high crest factor is giving you brief instance of amplifier limiting. Therefore, you may put in only one sine wave of signal plus that noise, and you'll think nothing but the noise but signal is coming out. Well, because your amplifier is being shoved into limiting by the peak value of that noise, even though it's very infrequent, it is mixing together that sine wave of signal with that noise, making other terms. The way you'll see it on a spectrum analyzer is your beautiful sine wave signal starts looking like a mountain.